Well, we are beginning Hebrews chapter 3 today, but before we do, I have an announcement I need to make sure that I get out to all of you. 2 weeks from today, we have an opportunity that we really want to take advantage of. That will be the Sunday immediately following the Ironman Summit. So on the 25th, we have Ironman. And on the 26th, partially because of some of the people that are attending Ironman, we have another opportunity that we've decided, that's come up in the last few days, and decided to take advantage of it. One we've known for a while, and that is that Brett Laird, who's been here before, but is in California. He's a missionary in the Ukraine, but he's been in the States for a while now, a little over a year. And personally, I'm not sure exactly when he plans on going back. He's doing some other things here in the States with teaching in the seminary or in the college, I'm not sure which, and some other things. But you know, he does plan on going back. I'm just not sure when. But he's going to be bringing our message in the church service that Sunday. But in addition to that, I always get his name wrong. That's why I write it down. Last name is Ramos. The first name is Diego. I've got a fixation on a different name. I won't say it because I don't want to reinforce it in my head. But Diego Ramos is he is the connection, the primary connection we had with the missions trip that Dave Hintz, Mark Van Ocker, and Peter Hoff went on into Brazil last year. But Diego and a couple of Brazilians, who are students at the seminary, I believe now, are going to be here for the Ironman, and then Sunday they're gonna stay over, and we're going to do kind of a missions emphasis Sunday. And so we are asking them to present, and during the Sunday school time we'll be in the big room and all the Sunday school classes will be together, and it's just a chance to hear what's going on a mission front, and maybe some of Diego's plans as he prepares himself for some specific things he's working on as potential missions. None of that's, you know, it's just a chance to get to know them a little better, to make a more direct visual link with some of the people that our people were working with when they were down in Brazil, some of the slides you saw and so on. And so it's just a, you know, it's a time for us to just grow and learn about what's going on there. So 2 weeks from today, the 26th, instead of meeting here, we'll be meeting out in the big room with the rest of the Sunday school classes at this time. Okay? All right, so Hebrews chapter 3, and to begin with, we're just going to look at or study the first six verses. One of the challenges in the book of Hebrews is there are so many details. The author weaves together well-crafted, full expressions of argument. There's so many different ways you can understand and look at and get a richness that's here in the book of Hebrews. So we don't want to miss those details. We want to see it and get it, and at the same time not lose our perspective on the way of where he's going and what he's doing. So this morning is one of those days when there's a lot of details we can take a peek at, and we are going to look at them, but we also want to make sure that we keep in front of us the big picture of the higher level view of what the writer is telling us. So let's begin today by reading chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, and then we'll see if we get beyond that. There's no real need to go back to chapter 2 and get the ball rolling, because we'll do that in our discussion anyway because of the first word that we're going to read. So who has those six verses for us?
Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and the high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. For this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. But Christ, as the Son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end.
Okay, a lot in those verses. And the first thing that's in there is the word therefore. So he starts out saying therefore, and then he names him and goes on with his argument. So what's he referring back to that's the link in this term therefore? And the easy place to do is just go back and look at verses 10 through 18 of the previous chapter. It starts out, it was fitting for him whom are all things and through whom are all things and bringing many sons to glory to perfect the author of salvation through sufferings. And what's going to happen in that last part of the previous chapter is this expression of Christ and the fittingness of him to bring about the salvation of many, bringing many sons to glory. That's many people being saved. And that Jesus would do that by sharing in flesh and blood, by living out man's experience, being humbled for a period of time. And in that humbling and that humbling period, to be even for a while lower than the angels from the previous chapter, to die on the cross and save many through his blood and flesh sacrifice, through living out a perfect life, despite being here, be living out our experience, going through the temptations we go through, being perfect, and still saving mankind as a perfect sacrifice on the cross. And then able to be there and aid us as a great high priest. So that's kind of the quick summary of those previous verses. So because of Jesus and the role that he plays of being God's son, yet living out flesh and blood sacrifice and becoming our high priest. Therefore, in chapter 3, verse 1, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. So he addresses this to who? To whom? I'd have to think about holy that one. Holy brethren, what does that mean? The brethren's easy enough, isn't it?
Follower of Christ.
Follower of Christ. But how do we get to the holy? So are you
well,
holy?
Well, he's no longer lower than the angels. Now he's above that.
But not him being holy here. The brethren are the ones that are holy.
Okay.
Well, in John 6 would be those the Father has given to us.
Well, let's just take it a few. This is one of that I started in. I go, I'm going to pick a verse or two to point this out. And my verse or two turned into about nine of them. So let's start over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and really get an understanding of where this holiness comes from, that the writer is able to look at us and say, look at the brethren that he was directly writing to and call them holy. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 17.
If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are.
Okay, so what do we learn from those verses about our holiness, or about the holiness of followers of Christ? Why would we call the brethren holy based on this verse?
Well, the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit.
The body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. And if you look at that verse, as a matter of fact, if we backed up to verse 16, don't you know that you are the temple of God and the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, and that's what you are. It's something that God has established. It's his temple, and that temple is holy, and that's what we are, is that temple. Ephesians 1, 4. There's another one to look at.
Just he chose us and him before the foundation of the world that we would be holy and blameless before him.
Okay. So, what is the basis of the brethren being called holy from that verse?
We're set apart.
Okay.
Chosen.
Yeah, that's the part. God looked at people, chose some, and said, and they were chosen to be holy. That's a part of his choosing and his will, is that they would be holy. Go back to chapter 5 there in Ephesians, and let's look at verse 27. My fingers are turning way too many pages here. Ephesians 5:27. Now, this is in the middle of, kind of picking a verse kind of context, so let me put the context here. This is in the middle of the admonition to husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And now he's talking about Jesus' purpose in loving the church. So let me read verse 27.
That he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless.
Okay, so that's how Christ loved the church. I'm sorry, that's the purpose for which Christ loved the church, that he would be able to present that church to himself, no spots, no wrinkles, holy and blameless. And so that's why back in verse 25, when he's describing the love the husband should have through the wives, Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to sanctify her. So it's out of that sacrifice of Christ, but it gets to and makes the brethren holy. Go over to Colossians 1:22. I think by accident I have these in the order you find them in the scriptures. Colossians 1:22.
In the body of his flesh through death, to present you holy and blameless and irreproachable in his sight.
Okay. So here it says, I should have probably given more context to some of these. But he has reconciled us in his fleshly body through death, so that we could be presented before him holy and blameless beyond reproach. So it is in that through his death that we are able to be presented holy. Go over to Colossians 3:12 now.
So as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness and patience.
And it goes on to talk about many other aspects that we should bring into our existence because we are chosen of God, holy and beloved. So now let's go over to 1 Peter 1. If you got a comment, I'm kind of going by a little quick here maybe. You might kind of keep in your mind what those are. When we get through these, we'll stop and talk about them a minute. You can certainly significantly add to our discussion when we get to that. 1 Peter 1, 15 and 16.
But as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, as it is written, be ye holy.
Now this kind of took a little bit of a turn for us, didn't it? We have been listening to verses, and so far, before we got to this verse, what would we have said? Let's talk about some of the things about our holiness. Where does it come from? It comes from God. How?
Salvation through Christ.
Salvation through Christ. There's a number of things to bring out about that. When Jesus was put to death on the cross, it was done for what? Our salvation. And what did we need saved from? Penalty of sin. So Christ took care of, died for, paid the penalty for, satisfied everything that there was about what it meant for us to be sinful lives and separate from God because of our sinfulness. What does it take to be in God's presence?
Holiness,
absolutely. So God is holy, and for anything to be in his presence, it too has to be holy. And so here is Jesus Christ intentionally paying the debt on the cross. We also, and as a result of doing that, then the brethren are holy. Now, who's the brethren? Well, what's that?
We are.
Well, we are.
The believers.
The believers. We could also flip that over and go back to Ephesians 1, and it's the one God chose to be brethren. So even by the intention of his choosing, you know, he has set about to make them holy. We could have looked at Romans 8, and we will a little later, where it talks about God's path of choosing and moving on down through predestination and sanctification and all that. We've got another reason to look at that a little later. But that's what we see being the work that God does in saving people. And the basis for the holiness is God accepted what Jesus did on the cross and in his will determined that would be adequate for us to be seen, for believers to be seen, for the ones addressed as brethren in the book of Hebrews to be seen and actually be in God's presence as holy. Now, when we come over here to 1 Peter 1, in this 15 and 16, it takes a little bit different turn, doesn't it? It started out there, but be like the Holy One who called you. I put a little bit of the onus on our back to be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, you shall be holy for I'm holy. And so here in this verse, we are called to be holy, not just called like called because Jesus said, I'm calling you to be mine, but called in the sense of, I'm calling you to do this. It's a command, it's a direction, it's an admonition placed on us to be intentionally, quote, holy. Now, certainly out of who I am, I know I'm not capable of truly being holy. But what I'm really being asked to do here is to meld my will with what God's will is for me and be aligned with that. And live out what, you know, you could very much say this is a very descriptive way of talking about working out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You don't save yourself, but you work out your salvation. You live out the salvation that has been given to you, and part of living that out is to be intentionally free from, shying away from, running from sin, and not just running from sin, but running to the things that God would have you do that are righteous and holy, the good works that he has for you in his sight. Questions, comments so far? Yes, sir.
I guess it's the old positional versus spiritual idea about salvation. God gives it to you and places you in the position and then says live it out experientially.
Yeah, I would say I definitely agree with that kind of a way of talking about it. But I also like the bridge between it, because you wind up in this situation where it's really hard to see that as an absolute dichotomy, because it isn't that God chose me, so now it's up to me to go be holy. I mean, because I'm born again is the only reason I would want to be holy. And it's only in being born again that I would find the insight and the will and the strength to be holy. So all that gets kind of fuzzed together a little bit or a lot when you start to think about how to live out holiness. As a non-born again person, non-regenerated, you know, the way Jesus described the Pharisees as being lifeless and dead, you know, you just can't do it. You can't even visualize it. You can't see it. You're blind to it. But with the being regenerated, reborn, then you can not only see it, but you can also have some insight into how to do it. Your conscience becomes active in a different way to say, no, I can't be a part of that. That's just, ooh, you know, and you go in different directions. And you know, it's easy, it's correct to talk about that as two different things, where there's a positional place and there's the behavior place. But when it's all said and done, you can't ever get away from both of those being involved. Questions? Other comments? Good comment. Okay, well, we got a couple more. If you were counting, we didn't get to 9 yet. 1 Peter 2, 5 through 9. So I didn't need to turn the page. 1 Peter 2, 5 through 9. Somebody read that when you get there.
1 Peter
2, 5 through 9.
You also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for the holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For this is contained in Scripture. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone. And he who believes in him shall not be disappointed. This precious value, then, is for you who believe. But for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builder rejected, this shall become a very cornerstone and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were also appointed. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a chosen nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light.
Yeah, I really like this passage. It kind of even goes into what we were just talking about this dichotomy of positionally versus behaviorally and so on. As you look at that, it starts out with, you also as living stones are being built up for a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. And so that's his start out, is Peter saying, you're being put together, assembled as a holy group to play a priesthood role. Now, we're over here talking in Hebrews about Jesus Christ as a holy high priest. And the book of Hebrews is the only place that talks about Jesus Christ and assigns him up as this high priestly role. It makes a lot of sense, and it particularly makes sense if you're talking to a Jewish audience for a lot of reasons. This is a little different. This is just saying as a group. I mean, think about the priesthood under the Jews as the analogy. You had the high priest, and then you had a lot of priests doing a lot of different work. And so what he's saying here is, you are one of many priests who are being assembled, put together, like a house being built, to serve God as holy priests in a spiritual house, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God. And he talks about then Jesus Christ being the center of that being built up, of that being established, as him being the cornerstone, and how he's a problem for those that reject him, and so on. But then it finishes up with, in verse 9, and this reads a little bit different than the version Jeff was reading, but you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, this said a chosen nation, this is a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of the darkness into his marvelous light. And so this passage kind of bridges the gap between God establishing you as being holy and making you holy, as well as then that giving us, giving the brethren, a role to live out in intentional holiness, where we're aligning our wills with God, putting everything we've got behind that holiness, while yet still remaining dependent upon God as the one who builds us up as this priesthood to be holy. Apart from his building, we could not be holy. And yet, so it's aligning both God's will and ours as one, just as we were talking about a few minutes ago. Questions? Thoughts?
Yes.
Go ahead.
How do we offer up spiritual sacrifices?
Well, that's a good question. How do we do that?
Don't everyone talk at once.
Well,
Romans 12:1 indicates that your life is, I guess, if this idea of holiness is a spiritual sacrifice. I mean, we are to give him everything.
Okay, so that's a piece of it. Offer up our bodies as living sacrifices, which is holy and acceptable and perfect in God's sight, that we may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and holy and acceptable and perfect. I kind of messed those up. But.
Yeah, the other thing in verse 9 here, where it talks about that's your only path to liberty, mm-hmm. basically to become the servant. So that's the other dichotomy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but practically, isn't it? I mean, the sacrifice, we're getting up Sunday mornings, and instead of going to play golf or going to do whatever, we're mm-hmm. sacrificing our time. Sacrificing when we make a stand for Christ and are persecuted, we're making that sacrifice of choosing God over man's pleasure, all those things that we give up.
There are some things that we, quote, give up, that we readjust our priorities for, but I'm going to say it does need to go a bit further than that. I don't know if I want to say it quite that way, because I don't want to take anything away from that. I mean, we do get our priorities realigned. Where we would spend our time shifts. But it's real easy to look at those things that build us up when we're in the receiving mode. Because when I come to church, and you know, I teach here, but I really receive more than I give. But when we come to church, we listen to the preaching, we're part of the teaching, whatever, we go through those things. So much of that we do is a building up of us. I think it's got to go beyond that. One of the things that, and I probably haven't done it as much in recent years as some previous years with some of the pastors in the personal interaction is, you need some personal ministry that goes beyond the things that we have made your responsibilities in the church. Because it's very easy to get involved with all these ministries and all these responsibilities and somehow feel like we're doing a great thing. And we are. But there's a personal side to serving Jesus Christ that needs to go beyond the official assignments involved in a church. You know what I mean? It's an attitude thing. It's deciding to go out and give up this night to do that, to help somebody out. It's when you're giving to others. It's when you're representing Christ out of your own heart. And we all need that. And one of the challenges in the very brief time that I was in paid staff that I recognized was if you do everything out of your responsibility to, quote, your employer, you lose something. There's something very definitely missing that if you go very long that way, you're going to dry up and blow away because you're not really carrying out that priesthood role. So some of those things you mentioned, I give up the golf on Sunday morning and I'm picking one of the more frivolous ones, and instead I'm in church. Well, in reality, that's more of a receiving kind of thing. They're also a balanced Christian goes beyond the receiving. Now, there are periods of life. There are periods of life that when you're devastated by the events of life, you're going to be much more in receiving mood potentially. But there's going to be those other times when you have opportunity to somebody else who has been currently devastated to be the one giving, either through just taking care of some physical needs or all the way up through counseling and, just directing their attention back to Christ. So that was a longer answer maybe than what you expected.
That was a good answer. Thank you.
And besides that, I mean, if we busy ourselves only with the church ministries that we have, which are not bad, we're not going to reach those people that aren't coming in the door.
Uh-huh.
Our neighbors, the people at school, wherever you are, your job.
Yep.
I think one thing people, our attitude about that, because I know if you're in a church where you're always doing these things and always doing those things and always doing that thing, and you have an attitude basically where this is my sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to know that when you start talking about your church and your God. So
yeah.
You have the attitude that this is, my who, gift or whatever.
Who are you glorifying? Right. Turns out to be the question. And you need to glorify the Lord, not yourself. Mm-hmm. Got one more. Let's go to Revelation. Chapter 15, verse 4.
Who shall not fear you, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. For all nations shall come and worship before you, for your judgments have been manifested.
Okay. So when we look at that, we see the declaration that who will not fear and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. For all the nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. Now that kind of almost flies in the face of what we just were saying. That in this end time, we're looking and say, God alone is holy. And that's true. So why can we be called holy brethren?
We are only
Yeah, if we go back and look at the big picture of the passages we read, it's because the Holy One, God, did some choosing, chose to build us up as a royal priesthood, a holy priesthood, to do this work, to show his holiness, to be as an ambassador for him, to live out a holiness that is in conjunction with the calling with which we've been made. He chose us in him before the foundations of the world that we might be holy. Not that we would make ourselves holy, but that we would be holy through his work. So why does it work out that we are holy? Because God alone is holy, but it's God as the builder that makes us holy. And then as being made holy, then we are to live that out. So let's go back to Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1. Why to make such a big deal about this? Well, first of all, it's kind of fun to study our own holiness or the holiness of brethren. It's good to recognize where that comes from. But when we read this title, Therefore Holy Brethren, we can know from what we've read that gives us no excuse to be big-headed about our holiness. It gives us no reason to think that, well, it's because we were wiser or smarter than somebody else, and therefore now because of the decisions we've made, we become holy. But at the same time, it keeps us from running from our own holiness. That's easy to do. We push, because the Bible pushes hard on understanding that it is God who's at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. We put all these things on God. We constantly talk about how we are unable to save ourselves. We talk about how we're unable to be holy. We talk about how living in this life, like Paul said, who's going to rescue me from this body of sin and death, that sin and death just follows us around because that's our nature. And that's just a part of who we are. And that's why it was necessary for Paul to say, when sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And go on to say, so then shall we sin more so there be more grace? No. Run from sin. And yet we know that we're sinful. And sometimes it's easy for us to accept our sin. You know, when we look at some of the ways in which the world elevates man and man's decision and man's work in the course of salvation, we look upon that with a little bit of disdain, because we recognize that takes away from the glory of God just a bit, maybe a lot in some cases. And so, you know, it's kind of like, no, you don't save yourself. You know, this is work of God. This is what God did. Glorify him for that work. But in the course of doing that, we can forget or not put emphasis on, we are called to be holy. We are called to align our will with God toward holiness. And so the mere fact that we are unable to become sin-free on our own, and that Jesus has to keep dying on the cross for our sins, so to speak, it can easily lead us to too much acceptance of our own weakness and succumbing to temptation and being sinful. And so I kind of want to get that balance out there with this title, Holy Brethren.
It can also lead you to the attitude that, well, we were talking to a guy yesterday who believes that, oh yes, you're saved by God, but you can do things that salvation goes away. And this idea that you know where that salvation comes from, and you know the results, what the results should be, but you may not make it. And also, I guess you would say insurance against that idea.
I was just going to tell you that we're going to get to that this morning. That's it. No, we're not. We used up a lot more time than I realized we would here. But before we're done with this, that last verse, verse 6, when we get to that next week, or the way this is going, maybe the week after or sometime down the road, when we get to verse 6, that raises those questions just in a huge way. And so we'll deal more with that, Don, when we get to those verses. But let's go ahead with verse 1. Maybe we'll get through verse 1 today. Partakers of a heavenly calling. So therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling. What does it mean to be partakers?
accepted?
Well, we've accepted it, that's true.
Mine says share.
Share, that's pretty good. But that word partaker.
Well, we were chosen, so we are part of it.
Well, we are part of it. We're participants is a good word to go along with partakers. But we're taking it in. If you partake of dessert, what did you just do?
You ate it.
You ate it. You consumed it. It's now part of you and you're part of it, so to speak. I don't know if I want to go too far down that line. But when we're partakers, we're involved in it, we're a part of it. And so we are directly involved in, recipients of, and participants in a heavenly calling. And that just reinforces this term, holy brethren. Our calling isn't just, here's a good cause, would you like to be a part of it? You know, this is a heavenly calling. To go to a very poor analogy of it, but we received, going back to some movies of many years ago, an offer we couldn't refuse. I mean, this is a high stakes calling. Now, I don't mean it's high stakes in the sense that we're more in jeopardy or that we've got some sort of a godfather type God that's going to whip us into shape or terrorize us into shape, but this is a heavenly calling. This is something you can't take lightly. You can't just receive it and just go living your life as though, you know, it's just another thing in my life. No, this is a heavenly calling. This overshadows the rest of life just because of its origin. So I think what we're seeing in this first verse here in chapter 3, the writer of Hebrews looking at these people and saying, you have got to take what we're talking about seriously. You're holy brethren, you're partakers of a heavenly calling. So now, with that in mind, consider Jesus. What does the word consider mean?
Think about.
Think about? Imagine a brochure for a vacation. And the words were, consider visiting this fine place and all the things you might see.
You're going to dream about it.
Well, you're going to dream about it, but the word consider there, I think, is how easily could you brush that off? I mean, how much energy do you have to put into it before you say, I considered it? No. Or I considered it, yes. But I mean, when I think what we're looking at here is when it says consider, give careful consideration to. Really examine this with intention. Examine this in a certain level of detail. Really give some thought to this Jesus because of the context in which it's written. Your holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling. So consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. Interesting. Jesus as apostle, what does that mean?
Is it telling us to look at him in a sense that we can take it or leave it? Or is it telling us to look at him as the perfect example?
I think I'm glad you asked the question because if I didn't, let me say what I tried to say a minute ago another way. When we're asked to consider here, it's in the context of holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, you need to, you must, you absolutely have to give careful thought to examination of this person of Jesus Christ.
I am urgently.
Yeah, I mean, this is a compelling command.
And it's a big responsibility we have, too.
It is a big responsibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is, pay attention, he's getting their attention, he's really working at causing them to recognize that because of where they're at and what they're called to, they've got to really get involved in learning about this person of Jesus Christ and giving thought to him in the role of, in this case, apostle and high priest. So let's talk about that apostle. What does it mean?
Sent by the Father.
Absolutely. What's apostle really mean?
Messengers.
Sent ones. Messenger? Yes. Those both fit pretty well. But he is the sent one of the Father. And there's a couple verses I'd like to look at for that. One of them is a parable, and I'm going to manage our time so we at least get through verse 1. Matthew 2, 33 to 46. This is the parable of the landowner. Matthew 2, 33 through 46. And let me just walk you through this parable, if I can ever get there. I cannot seem to turn to where I want to very well today. Matthew 2.
Matthew 2 doesn't have that many.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Let's think about this again. I wonder if it's Matthew 22, because that would be about where it ought to be. Parable of marriage fees. No, but I'm close. There it is. Matthew 21. I'm going to correct that in case I ever look at this again. Matthew 21. I just didn't get the one written down. Matthew 21, 33 through 46. Yeah, I should have known better than that. Matthew 2 couldn't have parables in it. Okay, so he talks about another parable, and it's about a landowner who planted a vineyard. And planting vineyards was something pretty valuable. When you look at the scriptures, the typical corollary for stories, for parables, for illustrations about the vineyard, up until this time, and for the most part, including this time, the vineyard represents the kingdom of Israel in almost every case. So here's this landowner that built a vineyard, put a wall around it, put a wine press in it, built a tower, and rented it out. He had a full going concern. He had all the pieces and parts for a functioning vineyard that should be profitable in growing the things from the vines. Okay? And he went on a journey. Okay. So he went somewhere else. I don't know if it was doing, you know, this is a parable, so there wasn't a real person that did this, so we don't know what he was doing, but he's out doing something else in this story. And when the harvest time approached, he sent slaves to the vineyards to receive his produce. He rented this out. He would expect a share of the crop. The vine growers took his slaves, beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. And then he sent another group of slaves larger than the first, and they did the same thing to them. So then he sends his son to them saying, they will respect my son. When they saw the son, they said to themselves, hey, if we kill the son, then we can seize his inheritance. We can own this for ourselves. It'll be ours. They took him, drew him out of the vineyard, and killed him. So when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to the vine growers? And of course, he's saying this to Jews and Jewish leaders, and they have a very quick answer. And what's the answer?
Put him to death.
Yeah, he's going to exact appropriate punishment, response, retribution, which you killed my son, you're definitely coming out of the vineyard, and you will not survive this. So when we go back and look at the pieces and parts of the story, clearly it's easy to understand this is Jesus coming to God's chosen people. At the time this was done, that is the Jewish nation. They are the ones that God has called to himself. He's there to collect from amongst them his rightful due. And so you have this conflict with the Jewish leaders and so on and so on. And before we're done, this will include the Gentiles as well. But so here's Jesus come to his own. And how was he received? He was there as God's representative to be Messiah. And while their version of what a king looked like in God's was different, God was setting Jesus up as king, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. His coronation event was a little odd in that it was a moment on a cross, a day on a cross. But Jesus clearly is the sent one of God. This parable kind of goes down that path. But better words, more clear, John 3, 16 and 17. Some of you know at least one of those verses. John 3, 16 and 17.
Well, that goes without saying. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but into the world to be saved.
So here is God clearly seen as the sender. You know, we see in verse 16, God is the giver. He gave what? His son. But in 17, it goes on to say, God sent him, and this is why. And we could go through a lot of different verses, if we wanted to, about God being the sender. We can go through a lot of verses about Jesus saying, I'm only doing what I see my Father doing. He was a very faithful responder to what God did. But God intentionally sent his son Jesus. And that's why he's the sent one. God sent him to the earth for the purpose of humbling himself and all the things that we've talked about prior to this in the flesh and blood life and death on the cross. But he's apostle and high priest. What's a high priest do? We've talked about this a little bit.
Intercedes
for the people. He's the link between God and men, mankind. And we can go over to in Timothy where it says, for there's one mediator between God and men, the man Jesus Christ. And so he's there in that intermediary role. But part of what the high priest does is he goes into the Holy of Holies and asks God to accept the blood that he's offering here as a sacrifice for the yearly sins. It's the yearly sin offering, that whole situation. Jesus does that once for all, but then he stays in heaven being an advocate for us, that when we sin, according to John, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus the Christ, who's there pointing out, I paid for that sin. That's covered. And so Jesus is there as high priest of our confession. What is our confession?
We confess that Jesus is Lord.
Okay. Romans 10, 9 and 10. That's a good one to look at. Claire Marie kind of took us there, which is fine.
If you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes to righteousness, and with the mouth confesses made by salvation. Confession is made by salvation.
Okay.
To salvation.
So it's that outward expression that Jesus is the Christ, and coupled with that belief in your heart that he's risen from the dead, we know he's the deity that's real. That's what Romans 10, 9 and 10 talks about. What's the most famous, quote, confession? It isn't called a confession in the Gospels. What's the most famous confession of all?
If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us of all unrighteousness.
Well, that's about confessing sins.
Right.
But that's not... What's that?
Who do people say that I am?
When
Peter's
response to Jesus' question, he starts out, who do people say that I am? They get all these answers. He says, well, who do you say? And Jesus, and Peter says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus turns around and says, well, flesh and blood didn't reveal that to you, but my Father who's in heaven, which is an interesting perspective on understanding who Jesus is and how that couples in with salvation. But that's the most famous confession of all. It's an interesting word that has been used historically for us in English about these kinds of, I'm going to use the word declarations, confessions. John 12, 42 and 43 is an interesting use of this word, just to show you how it lines up with what we're talking about in context. John 12, 42 and 43.
Nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him. But for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they love the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God.
You know, isn't that interesting? They believed, but they wouldn't confess. And can't you see how that would really, from our English perspective, right? And I don't know how well this fits the culture, that word in the culture there, but imagine if they spoke English and you've got all these Pharisees around, you've got the Jewish leaders and you're sitting there and they're ridiculing Christ. Wouldn't the word confession fit where you say, I have to confess, I believe in Jesus Christ? I mean, isn't that the right word in those kinds of oppressive settings? I confess. And really, when we're before the world, that's what we're doing. I've just got to confess in front of you, I'm a believer in Jesus Christ. And so that's, it's interesting to me that, that in John they used that word and how it fits in that context. Yes, sir.
To me, the key that I see for me here is that they feared man, the
yep.
Pharisees, and they didn't fear the Lord. So they chose the world and they chose man.
Uh-huh.
And now if they confess that they chose the Lord, then they would have been put to death, wouldn't they?
Oh, I don't know if they would have been put to death, but they would have found themselves in that era being ostracized from the community. They weren't going to be welcome in the temple. They weren't going to be welcome in whatever synagogue they might have been a part of. They certainly were probably even going to be unemployed. All those things in the Jewish life flowed around that. And of course, if they were Jewish leaders, if you were a part of the leadership, I mean, you might have been in danger for your life. I don't know how that would have worked, but it wasn't necessarily guaranteed that they would have been killed at that moment.
I really wonder, though, can you really say that you believe in him if you wouldn't confess that you believed in him?
Well,
be a true believer?
Well, you put a title on it. Let's go back to the first way you asked it the first time. Yeah. Can you really believe and not confess? Absolutely. And not be a Christian or saved? The demons believe and shudder. So you can know that's the truth and choose to reject it. In terms of reject it for, I'm not going to yield myself to that truth. I know it's the truth. I'm choosing not to yield myself to it.
You won't truly know it, though.